Okay. And we'll call the next case on our calendar. It's the case of In Re AE Liquidation, Inc. et al. Mr. Raisner.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jack Raisner for the plaintiffs, Annette Varela and John DeMura, firm Alton and Golden. And I would like to request 2 minutes of rebuttal.
That request will be granted.
Thank you.
We're glad you made it back from your visit to the Capitol.
It was a very interesting experience, Your Honor. Thank you.
We didn't want to deny you that opportunity, but I hope you understood that we're here this week and we needed to get this resolved. So I'm glad
It worked out just perfectly well, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you very much for your consideration.
You requested how much time for rebuttal?
2 minutes, please.
That request will be granted.
Your Honor, when parties consent to sale with inherent risks, they should be able to go ahead with the sale of a business. But if those risks are realized and those parties are harmed, the law is not offended because those parties accepted those risks when they went into a risky sale. But if the risks in that sale are realized and they harm employees who are not informed that these risks were coming down the pike, then those employees are going to be harmed, and they will have not had a chance to consent or to prepare themselves. And in that case, the law is offended, and the law is the WARN Act. The WARN Act was passed to give such employees 60 days advance notice so they could prepare themselves for the harms that befall people who are suddenly unemployed and have financial crises that follow.
Mr. Raisner, Judge Greenberg is not here in person, but it is listening in by audio. Make sure you keep your voice up. If you'd raise that microphone just a little bit.
Thank you.
Now, how did you know, though, that it made any difference to the employees, that it really caused them to lose their jobs? And the court found, and apparently it's clear, that it was beyond the 60 days, or after the 60 days passed, the notice had to be given. But how do you know that it would have caused the failure to give it caused the loss?
Your Honor, the company terminated the employees on February 19th of 2009.
Well, actually, it was later, but they made it retroactive.
Well, whether it was the 19th or the 24th, the employees were sent home without a job on the 19th and were told that they were terminated on the 24th, but that came as a complete surprise to them in the depths of the Great Recession. And so could have spent money on trips, on investments, on a home, on cars, up until that date, not knowing they wouldn't have a job on the 19th or the 24th. Not having a chance to send out resumes, not having a chance to look for the next job, to allow themselves time to retrain or to just prepare for unemployment, is a hardship that has been recognized by Congress and by this court.
But the law also recognizes that there's risk inherent in every business transaction, and so the particular exception we're talking about has embedded in it the reasonable foreseeability standard. And we're told by the regulations that also incorporates reasonable commercial judgment. Every court that has addressed this seems to have adopted a probability standard as informed by commercial judgment. Why shouldn't we adopt that standard, too?
Your Honor, the standard in the Act is reasonable foreseeability, not probability. And those are two different terms. And there should be no reason to go to a standard of what is the probable or the clear import of events Because that's not what Congress passed. To go to a higher standard than reasonability almost concedes that there were risks that were reasonably foreseeable.
How would you articulate the standard? Is it a mere possibility?
No, it's what is reasonably foreseeable to a similarly situated employer using commercially reasonable business judgment.
Does that mean more likely than not? How would you articulate that standard beyond probability, which seems like the way courts have tried to interpret reasonable foreseeability?
If we could talk about the facts of this case, Your Honor, I think it becomes very clear. There were, going into this sale...
We need a standard to apply to the facts of this case.
The standard should be and has worked fine for 20 years as reasonable foreseeability. That subject to an objective standard, not the subjective assessment of management, but to an objective, similarly situated employer, looking at a situation and understanding, would that person have perceived reasonably a foreseeable risk of closure? That standard works.
But employers can foresee that something could go two different ways. Is that enough? It's 50-50. Would you say that's reasonably foreseeable? And any time there is a business risk that might lead to layoffs, at a 50-50 probability that they need to send out a WARN notice?
I can't speak to every situation because every case is fact-sensitive, and it's a highly fact-sensitive issue applying the standards. To apply it in a void of just abstract numbers is very difficult. But let me just put it this way, Your Honor. Let's say you're at a roulette table, and the ball is in the air, and it's spinning around, and it can land on red or black. Is any of those two probable, one against the other? But they are both reasonably foreseeable because there are two outcomes, and one can be drastically different from the other. And if both of those outcomes are in play and the employer cannot tell which is it going to be, when this company ran out of money which was predictable, would it have its employees in its tow or would they be elsewhere? At that point, you do have to give a notice because the possibility of the...
No, you used the word possibility.
Well, no, the word possibility is not a bad term, Your Honor. In roulette, black and red are both possibilities. We can't tell which one it's going to be. You have to be clairvoyant.
Judge Greenberg has a question.
Yes.
Well, I just said if I was playing, it would come up green. I think they have a couple of green numbers, too.
That's correct. And there's always a wild chance that something truly unforeseen will happen. But when the odds are 50-50, as Your Honor suggests, and one will lead to means termination, and the other means possibly not termination, that is a reasonably foreseeable circumstance for which a WARN notice should be given, because those are actually fairly rare.
Help us understand how that would be workable, because that standard was rejected by the Eighth Circuit in Halkias because, among other things, of their concerns about its administrability. If every time there was a possibility, even a reasonable possibility of that outcome and a WARN notice sent out, we can't be blind to the fact, and the regs are actually sensitive to the commercial reality, that sending that kind of notice has an effect on the workforce and the continuity of the workforce, on business partners, on goodwill in the marketplace. Can we really use just a possibility standard? Wouldn't there be willy-nilly notices that needed to be sent out?
The mere possibility would be Justice Greenberg's green scenario. And it's 50-50, black or red. And that was the case in this company. It knew it was going to be liquidated or about February 14th. What it didn't know was whether its employees would be in its tow, would still be with it, or will the employees have, in a contingency, been shipped off to another employer. When you're facing that prospect in a liquidating bankruptcy, where the liquidation is known, it's planned, it's finite, and you don't know where the ball will fall in that situation, the typical practice, the routine operational practice in America, is to give an email, a WARN email, to that workforce and let them know that we expect that we are entering an APA, an asset a purchase agreement. We do not know. We are not sure if the employer is going to be hiring a locating job.
Is that what, I mean, what, you know, we have the WARN Act is there, and there, you know, there's some gray area, and we're arguing about the gray area here, when that notice needs to be given. But it seems to me that, accepting your argument, we may end up running the risk that any time there's a Chapter 11 filing, one of the additional papers that's going to have to be assembled in that filing will be a notice to all employees on the WARN notice. Now, is that good or is that bad?
Your Honor, that would not be the outcome. This is a case.
Why would that not be the outcome?
This is a case-specific finding and ruling in this matter, Your Honor. If you have a Chapter 11 liquidating sale and financing is in the bank, and the employees have been given agreements to join the purchaser, I would not send out a WARN notice.
That certainly is not the typical case.
It could very well be.
It could be.
It sometimes is.
Hear me a second.
Sure.
We're in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Okay. We're in bankruptcy. They were in bankruptcy. During the entire time they were in bankruptcy, there was the prospect of this sale, okay, which was in January, I believe, approved by the bankruptcy court. Okay? The sale was approved by the bankruptcy court. It was sort of a dead-end date of February 28th, the last date of the APA. Okay. My question is, under circumstances like that, do we always want to have a WARN notice? Is that really what WARN is about?
If the financing has such indeterminacy that's coming from the Kremlin with no expected date of appearing and no way to determine when it will come, then the answer is yes.
Okay.
When the buyer has made no effort to hire anyone, I think there is a huge question. We don't have to reach that in this case.
No effort to what?
It has made no effort to hire anyone. The buyer has repudiated any obligation to hire anyone in this asset sale and said it will not be responsible for having to do so. When you have a finite date, that time means everything.
Isn't that boilerplate? Didn't the bankruptcy court find that that language is boilerplate?
That is an opinion of a court that for which there is no evidence to support. There was no evidence as to whether that was negotiated or not, and how genuinely the buyer was committed to uphold and enforce that.
Well, answer me this. When do you think the WARN notice should have been given?
There is a strong argument that should have been given in December because of the track record of indeterminacy of the financing of this buyer with this particular amount of money from this source, which was the Kremlin, which for 6 months had been delayed with the same kinds of things that we know in December what will happen. But based on a track record where the buyer said, we have approvals of Vladimir Putin, but it's hard to say when the money will come. Having said that, for 6 months and coming into an asset sale with a narrow window. It's like jumping from a window of a building into a postage stamp trampoline. You have a risk that the indeterminacy of financing will conflict with the inelastic.
This is not your typical business, though. This was an entity that had been dealing with purchasers in Europe, purchasers in Russia. The members of the board and the principal shareholder had Russian ties. It was, as you said, 2008, 2009, everything was rocky everywhere. Maybe no more rocky in going to the Russian bank, VBE, than going to Mellon Bank or PNC Bank. The question becomes, you know, what was reasonably foreseeable?
In this case, there were so many contingencies and, as I say, indeterminacies, that it's a very strong argument that there should have been a simple routine message sent to the employees. We're entering into this, as I said, this asset purchase. We expect that the buyer will offer jobs, but due to the inherent uncertainties, we are letting you know that if the buyer doesn't offer jobs, that we expect that there will be likelihood of layoffs. And the date of the closing is the 14-day window in February. Just sending that email would have cured all of these problems. So the WARN Act is very reasonable, and that's what standard operating procedure is. For this company to not have done that was a violation of the law, and it doesn't send a signal to the rest of the country to say it should have happened in this case, to say that it happens in any case for any possibility whatsoever.
It's
much like
this.
So let's go ahead.
It may be fact-specific, but elsewhere, our own case law says that we look to the relationship of the business dealings between the parties. And when we do that here, seeing that there is a 20-something million dollar commitment that's made in November, that there are strong ties, as Judge Fischer said, between these parties, that there have been multiple investments that the buyer made in this company between December of 2007 and November of 2008. That we've got the bankruptcy court approving the sale, that there are no financing contingencies that are put on it. And then through February, on a near daily basis, they're diligently seeking and receiving assurances that this is getting serious review for approval at the highest levels of the Russian government, and that that's going to be turned around in a matter of days. The Spanish bank's financing was already secure. Why, then, looking at the specific facts of this case and that history of business dealings, isn't there enough, looking through the lens of reasonable commercial judgment, for them to believe that it was still likely, as they said in their initial notice to the on the furlough to employees, that the sale was going to go through?
Your Honor, with all due respect, the lower courts ignored half of the record. They ignored the first part of the sentence. We have commitments. We have assurances. We have optimism. The second part of the clause of every sentence that was ignored, and none of the dealings in the summer were cited, were, but we don't know when the money will come. We have other problems. It's hard to say what's going to happen next. So the full record, with all of the evidence, would show that any of that optimism was rebutted by an indeterminate statement that rebutted any assurance that should have been given. Plus, in February, it was no longer Eclipse's managers who were in charge. It was someone named Kent Cressa, who was the acclamation of all the creditors, the person to decide whether there should be a layoff. He said immediately, I'm not going to listen to any verbal assurances whatsoever. We will not consider them, which happens to be the WARN law, which you cannot give credence to any of these managers. And Roel Pieper, who was the CEO, is the prime insider. You can't give any credence. It's a hearsay rule.
Would you have our circuit then reject a presumption that other circuits have said goes along with a going concern sale, that those employees will continue to be employed?
The going concern sale was rebutted by the fact that the APA said specifically the employees will not be brought on board.
But the same agreement says it's 6.7 that Eclipse has to continue operating as a going concern, and that the employer can't take any steps that are going to impair the employee's availability for its future employer.
There's no evidence that sending a WARN email impairs anything. There is nothing inconsistent with giving a WARN notice in the midst of an APA sale. There has never been any evidence in any court, in any circuit, that has said that it has led to layoffs, that it has led to premature terminations, voluntary terminations by employees, that it has doomed anything or impaired anything. That is dicta. That language exists. But there is certainly no evidence on this record that a WARN notice would have done anything. To the contrary, the buyer, Roel Pieper, was happy to go ahead with the sale, even though he was told 75% of the employees would be let go. This was in November. He said, fine, we're going to take it anyway. So his sense of what a going concern sale is one thing, but and it didn't mean that there had to be employees. Your Honor, a going concerned sale does not mean that there won't be a mass layoff. A going concern sale does not mean that 100% of the employees will be brought on. The termination of 33% will be a violation of the Warren Act.
Is your position then that it is appropriate for courts to adopt a presumption of continued employment with a going concern, but on the facts of this case it's rebutted, or that presumption is an improper presumption
to
apply?
The Sixth Circuit says that the presumption is proper unless something else negates it or something else comes in the way. The something else is here are an elephant that you can't put into the mouse hole of just a something else.
Okay, Mr. Reisner, we'll have you back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Klayman?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Barry Klayman. I represent the appellee, Jeffrey Birch, who's the Chapter 7 trustee for AE Liquidation Incorporated. I'm here with my colleague, Mark Felger from Cousin O'Connor. Let me start. I had intended to start with what the circumstances were in December of 2008 that was facing the debtor at that time, but frankly, Judge Krause, you summarized it very well for me, what the situation was. The company had already filed for bankruptcy, so it was in bankruptcy at the time. It had this agreement, this asset purchase agreement that it had entered into. It was for the sale of the business as a going concern basis. And I would add to the judicial presumption that a going concern sale includes the transfer of the employees, that the Warren Act itself has an exclusion for a specific section dealing with the sale of a business, which imposes upon the buyer of a company that is being sold as a going concern the obligation to deal with the Warren Act. The theory is that it is the buyer who's making the decision whether or not to retain the employees, and therefore the buyer has the Warren Act obligation to notify employees if they're not going to be their employment's not going to continue.
Even if there is a presumption,
do they have to make that warning?
Excuse me.
Do they make it before the closing? At what point do they give that warning, the buyer?
As I understand the Act, the buyer gives that warning the time it makes the decision whether or not to continue the employees. In effect, there's a presumption that the employees are going to continue on in their employment, and then the buyer makes a decision as to which employees the buyer intends to retain and which not. And if the number of employees that the buyer does not intend to retain hits the threshold level under the Warren Act statute, they would be required to give the Warren Act warning.
So would that be after the buyer closes?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it would be after the sale closes.
So the seller has the obligation beforehand.
If the sale never closes, then the seller has the obligation to provide the Warren Act notice. And then the question is the relationship of the unforeseen business circumstance. If the reason the sale does not close is because of an unforeseen business circumstance, then there may be, then the warning is either excused or a late warning is permitted.
The going concern issue for the moment before we turn to the business circumstances. Even with the presumption, why, given the term, not only the terms of the APA here, but the testimony that was given by three different witnesses as to their unwillingness to commit to continued employment of the employees, why wouldn't a presumption be rebutted on the facts of this case? Do we really want to chalk it up to boilerplate when that's what the parties, that disavowal of any commitment to the employees has been stated expressly in the agreement?
Well, I think what's stated in the agreement is not a commitment to retain all of the employees. It really is a boilerplate provision that gives the buyer discretion as to which to continue and which not to continue. And I think Judge Walworth recognized that. And I think she's familiar enough with enough of these asset purchase agreements in the context of bankruptcy to understand that the buyer's not going to commit sight unseen to employing all of the employers, But on the other hand, the seller here had the obligation to retain all of the employees. It had an obligation to maintain the business organization and structure of the company. It had an obligation as well not to interfere with not to offer any employment, alternative employment to any of the employees or interfere with the buyer's ability to hire those employees. So I think in this case, this is not really the circumstances that would rebut the presumption that those cases are referring to. With respect to the testimony, I think you'll find that the testimony is a little bit conflicted. That is, the buyer, consistent with the asset purchase agreement, said, I haven't made a commitment to hire everybody. On the other hand,
Mr. Barber has testified that there were no plans or promises to retain Eclipse's employees, not a commitment not to hire everybody, or that he was going to be picking and choosing amongst a small group of management, for example. But with a general statement like that, why wouldn't that be enough to rebut a presumption?
I would say that would be offset by the fact that the asset purchase agreement required that the sale be on a going concern basis, that it required the seller to retain all of the employees until the time of closing, and that it prohibited the seller from interfering with the employment relation with the employees. I think you have to look at the entire context of the statement that he made. And I think in that circumstances, if the buyer chose not to retain employees, then the buyer would have had the obligation under the WARN Act to provide the warning so the employees still had protection, but the protection comes from the buyer, not from the seller.
How about foreseeability of the business circumstances here? I mean, at least at the point where the board wanted to speak with Russian counsel and get some understanding and assurance of what was going on and wasn't permitted to do so, at that point, shouldn't there have been a kind of flipping of the switch from a possibility to a reasonable foreseeability that there was really something amiss?
I think if you look at the circumstances that took place between essentially February 1 and February 24, when the conversion motion was filed by the secured note holders, that you don't find, you find an independent director who is trying to do his best to pin down the time closing is going to take place, when the funding is going to be available, when the bank that needed the additional capital was going to be actually recapitalized as opposed to the approval coming through. So, yes, there were issues that and questions that had been raised. But at the same time, as both courts below recognized, they were getting assurances. There were ongoing conversations with the state-controlled bank, with VEB. There were ongoing discussions at the highest level of the Kremlin, to the extent that the Kremlin had to be involved in approving the transaction. And it appeared, at least until I believe it was February 21, that they were making progress. And that there was still a lot of optimism that the sale was going to close, that the funding was going to be available. And I think that comes through even when you look at the minutes of the disinterested director meetings.
Well, Chapter 7 liquidation was considered at every meeting in February.
The fact that it was considered doesn't mean that they had either abandoned the sale or felt that the sale wasn't going to go through. I mean, the fact that they were preparing for contingency, I don't think suggests that they didn't think that the sale was no longer reasonably foreseeable. They were getting advice from lawyers who were saying, you have to be prepared for this, you have to be prepared for that. That doesn't mean that it rises to a probability, or that it was the circumstances that would have required the warrant notice.
Mr. Klayman, Halkias developed the probability test for reasonable foreseeability. But my question to you is that the right test? Reasonable foreseeability is not defined in the WARN Act. Reasonable foreseeability, if you look at its ordinary meaning, may not be the test that Halkias has come down with. Isn't our obligation to look at the text of the statute?
It is. I think you have to... Reasonable foreseeability is not defined. So the question is, when you look forward applying a commercially reasonable test, a commercially business judgment type test, what level of certainty do you have to have in order to assume that the circumstance isn't going to take place? And I think to classify it as a probability rather than a possibility makes a lot of sense. I think this court actually has already adopted that standard. I think you adopted that standard in footnote 7 in the Elsinore opinion. When the court made a distinction between a possibility and a probability in terms of whether or not a notice was required to be given. So I think that it is an appropriate way to deal with it. Whether it has to be 50-50 probability is another question, although I think that to understand it in terms of more likely than not makes a lot of sense to a business standard.
Do you need that standard to prevail?
I don't believe that we need that standard to prevail because I think that we still satisfy reasonable foreseeability test as long as that reasonable foreseeability test is not a mere possibility. Because I think the problem is that when you deal with the phrase mere possibility, there are a myriad of possibilities that can occur. It's a question of rolling a ball on a roulette wheel and trying to understand the probability of where the ball is going to roll. The probability of how that ball is going to land is sort of built into the roulette wheel. That's not the situation here. You can sit down in advance without knowing the facts, without knowing the circumstances, and come up with a whole host of a decision tree of a whole host of alternatives that take place if the test is going to be mere possibility. So what I would say is that even if you don't adopt the probability test, and I think the courts that use the probability test are talking about more likely than not 50% or better as a means of trying to understand reasonable foreseeability. But even if it's less than a 50% probability, I think that we still prevail. I think the only way we lose is if you adopt a mere possibility that anything can happen, which I think is the test that the appellant is advocating for, because basically the appellant says, well, once you're in Chapter 11 and you're going to go through a sale, you automatically have to give everybody a warning. And the problem with that is that when you're trying to sell a business to maximize the return on the business by selling a business as a going concern, you can't be in a position where you put out a notice that tells your employees, and particularly your most skilled employees, that now's the time to start looking, pack up.
Isn't the mere filing of bankruptcy itself perhaps enough notice to many employees to say, hey, we ought to be looking somewhere else. We're not sure how long we're going to be here.
It may be, and in fact, what that does is to cut against the notion that you need the WARN Act
in a
situation where you have a bankruptcy and the company's floundering.
But there is the WARN Act, and there's a requirement to comply with the WARN Act. Let me ask you about the disinterested directors. You had two disinterested directors, Mr. Kresna and Mr. Poland. And as of January 30th, I believe, they were ready to approve the Chapter 7 filing.
Well, actually not. If you look at the minutes of February 4, they made a decision not to make a Chapter 7 filing.
But on January 30th, they were leaning towards... They may have reconsidered their position. January 30th, they were leaning towards Chapter 7.
Well, they received, if you'll recall, they received an explanation of what was going on in Russia at the full board meeting on February 3rd. And then February 4th, the disinterested directors meet. They make a decision not to convert to a Chapter 7. They also make the statement in the minutes that they have no reason to disbelieve what's going on, what they're being told is going on in Moscow. And what they did is they instead request specific documentation of some of the things that they were being told were going on, that was going on in Moscow. And in fact, they got that specific documentation on February 5th, the next day, when they got a letter from the governor of one of the Russian regions who was involved in the sale transaction and talked about the decision being made to recapitalize the bank and reaffirmed the decision to go forward with the this particular project and to fund this particular project. You don't find anything further from the disinterested directors until February 11th.
But on the 4th, wasn't it Mr. Kressa who suggested the unpaid furlough?
He said we would have to consider it, but he didn't make the decision to do it. And the decision to do the unpaid furlough did not take place actually until February 16th.
February 16th.
Correct.
I guess the point is, though, from January 30th on, you seem to be moving down a road where there's more and more question about whether or not this closing is ever going to take place because of the possibility of this, the Russian loan to the company not arise.
I think that when you look at the record, what you see is as time goes on, at least until, I believe, February 21, the question is when is the loan going to close, not whether or not the loan is going to close. The money's going to be available so that the sale can close.
When did Eteric put in the $20 million additional DIP financing?
The DIP financing was put in at the very beginning.
So that was at the beginning.
Correct. And it was essentially matched by the, and this is very important to keep in mind, by the ad hoc committee of secured note holders who were making available millions of dollars to finance the company. Again, I think as a reflection of their reasonable belief that the sale was going to close. And my understanding about the way that the cash collateral order reads, it actually had money being freed up at various points in time. And if my recollection is, even the DIP order had the money being available at different points in time.
Does DIP order become does DIP financing become an administrative priority?
I believe it does, yes. Yes. But again, in terms of, and this goes back, I guess to the point that Judge Krause had at least adopted in the question, that these two companies had a long relationship, a long history, that Eteric had a lot committed to going forward with the sale and was doing everything possible to make the sale close.
How should we think about, as we're trying to define and apply a reasonable foreseeability, how do we think about the role of commercial judgment there? And keeping in mind that reasonable foreseeability and reasonable commercial judgment, at least the regs, would seem to suggest an objective standard. If we have a situation where there, over the course of time, and even a relatively short time, there are increasing doubts, and as a business reality, As the folks who are in the know look at the situation, they have reason to hope against hope because of how much is riding on the deal. Given what's involved from an investment perspective, even as that possibility, from the probability of it going through to a possibility to feeling like it's even under 50% likely. But what weighs on the other side has them wanting to hold on. Do we look at that to say, well, that's commercial judgment, and so that should inform whether this is reasonably foreseeable? How do we apply those two concepts and what seems to come across from the language of an objective standard?
I was going to say, while I would like you to adopt that standard that seems to have a certain amount of subjectivity in it, that's not the, as I read the cases and the cases that have been cited by both parties in this case, it's an objective standard. So while it has to be what is commercially reasonable, it is the court that is making, based on the information that it has, a decision as to when it becomes commercially reasonable to hold out hope that the sale is going to close. And I would suggest in this case that some indication of that came from the fact that the secured note holders when they filed the motion to convert the case to Chapter 7, if you read the motion that they filed, they said that it was as of, I believe they said, February 21, when it became probable to them that the sale was not going to close. And up until that point, I think the issue really was, when is it going to close? How much money is going to be made available at what time? And that's really what everybody was negotiating with.
We're reviewing the legal question here of when the notice had to be given on a plenary basis. But what finding of facts are there that the bankruptcy court made that support your position that we need to review for clear error?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Which findings of fact that the bankruptcy court made in this case do we need to look at as we review them for clear error?
Well, frankly, I think that the standard that you have, because it was a summary judgment motion that was granted, is plenary review.
It is?
Yes. And if I were to tell you a fact that I thought that the bankruptcy court got wrong, I would tell you that I didn't think she got any of the facts wrong, nor did I think the district court got it wrong. But what you're faced with is a plenary review. So it's not just a question of whether she abused her discretion or whether or not she was clearly erroneous in some finding. I think your review is a little bit broader than that.
I couldn't help when I read this case. I think in all my 43 years as a judge, I never saw a situation where the head of state approved a private loan. And I thought, you know, it's inherently very questionable whether that would happen. I mean, nobody's going to tell Putin what to do. I mean, you would think that people would be very concerned from the beginning of such a standard.
Your Honor, I can't speak to the exact procedure that was being followed in Russia as far as the loan is concerned. I know what the events were that happened, but I don't know the reason that they happened. I do know that at least as of the time of the asset purchase agreement, there was a commitment letter from VEB Bank. That's the fact of the commitment letter is recited in the in asset purchase agreement itself. And again, at the February 3rd board meeting, one of the IRTURB representatives sitting on the board made it very clear that he believed that the commitment letter that they had received from the bank was enforceable. So how exactly Putin got involved into the decision-making is not clear to me. I think it's not clear on the record, but I don't think that as businessmen sitting from the outset looking at the agreement that they were going to enter into and what was going to happen, that they thought that that was the thing that was necessary to the process because they had already had a commitment letter. I think the problem there was the unexpected circumstance of a state-controlled bank running into capitalization issues.
I have a question on sufficiency of the notice. And that's the WARN notice that was sent out. It doesn't reference the WARN Act itself. How could a brief statement of the basis for reducing the notification period satisfy the mandate of statute and give to employees the information they need to determine whether a notice period was properly shortened under the Act if there's no reference to the Act itself?
Well, there's no requirement that any notice contain a reference to the Act.
Well, that's the question.
To cite it. I have not seen any case law, and many of the cases that are cited by either of the parties in this say that it has to refer to the Act. What it has to do is to explain why shortened notice, why they couldn't get notice sooner. And the courts below, and we believe that the notice was sufficient because it explained why the notice was being given at the time that it was being given. And that is, it was because of the conversion of the case, the delay in closing of the sale transaction.
Which notice?
That's actually, that's the February 24th notice that said that. The February 14th notice was actually a notice of a furlough. And as we explained in our brief, that the furlough itself didn't necessarily require a WARN Act notice because it was not intended to be a long-term furlough. And under the statute, if the furlough is less than, I believe it's 6 months, there's no, it really doesn't, it's not an employment law, so it doesn't come under the terms of the WARN Act.
The actual notice was retroactive to the 19th, was it not?
Yes, it was, Your
Honor.
Does
the WARN Act allow for retroactive notices?
I haven't seen anything that says that it doesn't allow for it, and there is certainly a Department of Labor regulation that says there may be occasions when the notice may come out after the termination. So presumably that would allow for a retroactive termination.
Counselor, this case came up on summary judgment. When I review a case, I always write down certain thoughts I had. I wrote was this. Because of conflicting evidence, this is sort of a question. Because of conflicting evidence, we cannot say as a matter of law that it was not necessarily foreseeable that the company would be forced to make a layoff before February 24, 2009, when it sent out the WARN notice. And why is that wrong? Why is that wrong? How can we say that it wasn't until February 24th that it was not reasonably foreseeable?
Well,
isn't there a question of fact on that? Because we're on summary judgment.
We're actually on cross motions for summary judgment, which means that both parties asserted to the court that there were no material issues of disputed fact.
You know what? There's cases on that point. And the cases say that the fact that there are cross motions for summary judgment, that fact doesn't mean that somebody's got to get it. I can tell you there's a lot of cases on that.
No, that's correct, Your Honor, and I'm aware of those cases. The fact that it's what I am saying is at least both parties believed at the time that there was no disputed material fact. And in fact, all of the matters before the court were basically the writings that had been submitted to the court, which were the minutes of the various board meetings. And
yeah,
so what you're looking
but the reasonable foreseeability test, whether you put it in probability, possibility, whatever it is a subjective decision that somebody's got to make. It's not like a hard fact, like somebody made a loan on a certain day. So, I mean, wouldn't it have to be decided by prior to the fact?
I don't believe so, because actually I believe that the reasonable foreseeability is an objective test. So it is really the court looking at the facts of the case to make a determination as to whether or not it was reasonably foreseeable or not based on the commercial situation of the party, in a sense. And that's what the court had before it in the ongoing discussion among the board members and with the presentation that was made to the bankruptcy court at the time of the sale to get the sale approved.
Okay, Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you very much.
We thank you very much, and we'll have Mr. Reisner back for rebuttal.
Your Honors, I'd just like to clarify the probabilities test is not the Halkias test. It is the probable versus the mere possibilities. And just to illustrate, in the example of the red and black roulette, if the ball falls on the red, which causes doom to occur, and the employer says, we thought it was going to land on black and it wouldn't occur, it imposes a burden on the plaintiff to prove that the probable outcome would have been that it would have landed on red when those things were equal. That can't be the test. If those two things are equal, which they are, then both are reasonably foreseeable. That makes sense to Congress. That made sense to this court, that when those two things are equal, a WARN notice applies. If you impose on the plaintiff the burden of showing that the thing that happened was the probable, we will lose every time. We don't have the money. We don't have the ability to contest a contrary position by management, and that's why it's reasonable foreseeability. In terms of commitments, Your Honor,
Commitments are one thing. Fulfilling them is another. There are a lot of commitments in this case. Commitment to pay a DIP loan by eTurk of $10 million was made, but it was never paid. And Mr. Pieper is in Europe. He's on the lam because he never paid. eTurk never paid that amount. In terms of Vladimir Putin said in September, prior to the November bankruptcy, that he had that he had approved and signed off on what was called the factory project for the $200 million. But it was reported that it was hard to say, this was Mr. Pieper, hard to say when that money would arrive. So Putin had approved something in September, money didn't arrive, company goes into bankruptcy. And now fast forward to February 16th. The court records that on February 16th, it was reported that Putin approved the sale, and so no more approvals were necessary. The rest of the sentence, which the court did not quote, was that, but it could, we could not predict a specific closing. Putin or the Kremlin could not predict a specific closing. That was omitted. Well, on the 21st, it's reported that Putin had to think about it again, and when he would make up his final decision could not be estimated. So all that was redacted by the court to provide what is a skewed view of what was being said. And in terms of relying on any of those assurances, there is a case in the Sixth Circuit called Pena versus American Meat Packing, which is the case which says that we do not consider subjective assessment of foreseeability because it is an objective test. And as Judge Krause, as you mentioned, taking the word of people who are committed, they have a right. They have a right to be optimistic and to go through with the sale. We don't deny that. Go for it. But taking the objective stand, which is what the risks that you're undertaking are the ones that properly management should bear the consequences of, but employees should not bear the consequences of those risks. Those risks are the ones that trigger a WARN notice. Your Honor, in closing, the reason why the company closed was not discussed by my colleague. The reason the company closed was not because of black or red. The company walked away from the roulette table. It gave up. It threw in its chips and it filed for liquidation clause, and it told its employees in that 24th email, we have run out of time and money. That was the circumstance that they were staring at when they went into a liquidating Chapter 11 bankruptcy with a finite calendar of how many days they had, in which they had to fit all of the things that they needed to do to try to get a sale that would give the secured lenders their money back and maybe help the employees. But it was against that tight, inelastic deadline that these things couldn't possibly have been predicted to have occurred smoothly, because they had just been through a track record with Vladimir Putin where whatever he committed could not necessarily be counted on. And therefore, it was incumbent on the company to give a notice at that point. And certainly when eTurk came to the table empty-handed, saying we have no money, we don't know when we're going to get it, at that point, it was probable, and it certainly was.
When was that date?
That date was January 29th. And Eclipse was given over to the hands of the personification of an objective, reasonable businessman who would become head of GM in 3 weeks.
So
said,
they were,
so I am not going to take any... I'm sorry.
So they were late by 26 days. 27
but
days.
The defendant has never said what the unforeseen business circumstance was in this case. The defendant never said that the failure to come to the closing was the unforeseen business circumstance. Today, the defendant did not tell us what the unforeseen business circumstance was.
Wasn't the conversion to Chapter 7 the unforeseen business circumstance?
No, it wasn't, because Eclipse did that itself. It was the one before the...
Yeah, but the actual conversion.
Eclipse decided to convert itself, so it wasn't unforeseen. It decided to do that. The day before the lenders filed that conversion motion, Eclipse had authorized and directed the filing of their own conversion motion. So,
right.
So Eclipse walked away from the roulette table, and that wasn't unforeseen because it did it itself.
But
the reason it did it was because
it was
something that wasn't unforeseen.
Okay. All right.
I don't have anything else.
Even on the 29th, though, the board is being told not that we don't know when there's going to be financing, but there's now a delay until February 2nd. And granted, it seems like, as you look back, I mean, you know, hindsight's 20/20. You know, it appears to be a series of assurances that string them along through the month of January and into late February. But there's always a specific commitment of what is about to happen within a matter of days. This is on Putin's desk. We're going to hear something in a matter of days. While there are reasons to be doubtful, where there are also, on the record, those kinds of reassurances, why don't we need to defer to the commercial business judgment in ascertaining whether it's reasonably foreseeable or not?
Mr. Kressa personified commercial reasonable business judgment, and he said in February, I am not going to listen to any verbal assurances about what paper is on whose desk and how days. He needed to see documentation straight from the government that would say when the fund, that a approval was made, that funding was coming, and that there would be a clear closing date. He said that on February 2nd. That is clear commercial judgment. He was never given that. And he disregarded all of what was said by the people who were subjective and insiders. And he said, until I get that, I am shutting this down. And he gave every benefit of the doubt to use up the money that was in the till to see if we can get there. And that was prudent business judgment as well. But someone needed to send a warn notice at that point because it was reasonably foreseeable to someone like Kressa, to the secured lenders who put him in charge and said, you be the one to make that decision. That's prudent. And he made it reasonably foreseeable to everyone except the employees.
All right, Mr. Reisner, thank you very much. We thank both counsel for excellent arguments in this case, and we'll take the matter under advisement.
Okay, Judge Fisher, what do you want to do?
We'll call you.
You'll call me back?
Yes.
Okay.
You guys know it? No. Good evening, everybody.